What we would like to do is record a professional biography and, you know, tell how all of this developed. So maybe we could start at the beginning with some biographical background, maybe talk about your youth, your family, your education, growing up. Where are you from originally?
Actually from Belgium. Mm-hmm. Yes, and the reason that I was surprised by Mendel, because yesterday I gave here the kind of inauguration talk on the Holy Symposium. And Tony Holy has been since 35 years, actually since 1976, my co-worker. And yesterday I called him one of the big Czechs following Mendel, Hajrovský, and Vigelin. Mm-hmm. The discoverer of the soft lands.
Yeah.
So that's why I said,
right.
Since I'm not a Czech, but I'm certainly not from the progeny of a priest. Right. But it's surprising. I saw here the picture of Mendel. Yeah. It's, so to explain a little about, well, you probably have some of my biography, at least you have a picture.
and I also have a very long CV with I don't know how many publications on it, and that's a little daunting, but maybe we can go through a little bit of that, how the science developed over time.
That is I'm not going to give you a review of all my publications.
Well, maybe we can get a thorough summary.
The total work. Number is something like 2,500, mean, peer-reviewed. But you see, I'm pretty old, and I've had the opportunity to continue writing. Mm-hmm. So that, actually, to give a little bit about the biography, I do not know how far I have to go. I mean, to go back.
Well, let's,
I mean,
let's start at the beginning. Where were you born? What's your birthplace?
The birthplace is in a place called Dendermonde, which is in the province of East Flanders in Belgium. It is in the Flemish part of Belgium. As you probably know, there are two parts.
Right.
You have the Flemish part, you have the French part, or the Walloon part, and then you have a small, what I would say, part that is the German part, which we inherited after Second World War from Germany. So I grew up in let's say in a rural place. I mean, this is very far from what you could call any city, it's just incidental.
And,
that
and you're growing up maybe after the war and the years.
Well, actually, the first years I was born in 1941, so that means that the war ended in 1945, but I have no recollection. Of what happened during the war.
Right.
Certainly not suffering or anything of that. What I still remember vaguely is a kind of festivities for the liberation. So I was already 4 years old, and that was perhaps the date that I could still remember. I mean, it's... So, and I went to school and... a very small village. I mean,
What did your parents do?
My father was a chemist, but not a professor chemist. He was an employee chemist, and my mother was a tailor actually. So, and she worked with girls. I mean, and so I am an only son, so that. Let's say, never had sisters or brothers, but the girls that worked with my mother were kind of sisters for me. And my father was an employee in the chemistry in a plant of fertilizers. And I was used to always go with him on Sundays to the plant, and that's probably where I got my indoctrination in chemistry, because I smelled the sulfur. They used the sulfuric acid for the fertilizing purposes, I mean, for making fertilizers. And so perhaps that somehow determined my later what I would say later, inclination for chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Did you discuss chemistry with your father?
No, not really. I was interested in chemistry, but I never did like some other people have, that are real chemists have done experiments, you know, when I was young. No, I never never done it. But I mean, I was interested in chemistry, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But I was from a very simple, let's say, household. I mean, where my parents lived in an, let's say, very simple neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And it just, but that's incidental, I'm going to be an honorary citizen of that village within just a few weeks.
Wonderful.
So, and there I will speak my local dialect. Mm-hmm. So, because of course the English is not my mother language.
Sure, sure.
My mother could not even speak any English. Mm-hmm. My father could speak better French, but also no English. So, I didn't speak English at all. I mean, for until when I but now I'm jumping already a little bit ahead. Until I came to the U.S. in 1968. Now I'm jumping a little ahead because I spent part of my time and then at Stanford.
Ah.
So you see.
So you know the area.
I know the area very well, but it changed. I mean,
sure.
And, that, and I remember Embarcadero a little from, you know, the old days. We must have been here and gone to Fisherman's Wharf, and once we went even to Alcatraz sightseeing. And so that is not jumping ahead of.
When you go back to your village for the homecoming, do you still have friends there? Will you see people that you know?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And certainly in the neighborhood, I mean, the neighbors. I still have the old home of my parents. I so far have not been able to separate from it. So I still keep the old home, but it's really now due to renovation, I mean, that's for sure. But so I went there to the local what do you call that, junior class? Not junior yet, I mean the
there's the primary grade,
the primary
school,
grade,
middle school, high school.
And then I, at the age of 12, I changed to the place, to Dendermonde, where I was born, to the high school. And that was a high school based on what they call Greek Latin humanities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I had to learn Greek and Latin. And at that time, I have no idea what I would ever would like to become. I mean, it's so I had all the options at that moment. Actually, Greek and Latin was some kind of predestined to start studies in for priest, but I did not have the inclination for it. And then what determined my further career was a lot of things. I could do, I liked algebra, so that means I could do mathematics, I could do physics, I could do even what we call German philology. And
German philology with that's not algebra, you don't need...
And algebra, I was not very well educated to do that. I liked the algebra, but it was too weak, my education in that to start. And so my father, of course, he liked me to become a chemist, and my mother wanted me to become a doctor, and because, you know... we call that a doctor, that had a lot of prestige.
Yeah, so they had some ambition for you, too.
Well, because I was a good student, so I had several options. And what then determined when I had to go to the university, so from there on I went to the University of Leuven, which you call Louvain. in our native language. And so when I went over there, I was still not sure what direction, but then I was looking through the program, and to start medicine, they had a lot of courses of chemistry. And that was for me the, let's say, an ideal excuse to combine my mother's and father's aspirations. My mother wanted me to become a medical doctor, and my father liked to see me as a chemist. So
this was conscious in your mind.
And when I was 18, then I started medicine because I had so much chemistry. And I never regretted that. And what is strange that now, so many years, now we are talking about 60 years down the road or 50 years down the road, I mean, I still kept my love for chemistry, although I have become a medical doctor.
Jumping ahead a little bit, I'm curious. Do you find that your training in medicine helped you at all during the pharmacological chemistry? Maybe the understanding of physiology or...
Well, yes, yes, I would say, because I saw then later on the chemistry as a service to the medical problems. And the fact that I got a background in medicine certainly helped me in, let's say, putting the chemistry in perspective. Because I... To give a very, let's say, blunt comparison, you can do chemistry because of the chemistry and, let's say, study the hemocyanin of snails. But you can do the hemoglobin of man. And so my purpose then also became to do the chemistry of problems that were of importance in medicine. So, and therefore, my medical background certainly helped me in putting the things in perspective.
So let's go back then to, you undertake medical training, a lot of chemistry courses.
Lots of chemistry. Then I was very dedicated student. A very good student. And I was even writing the courses for the students on chemistry and biochemistry. So that's in my class, I mean, and at the university, these were big classes, there were around 300, 200 to 300 students per class. So this was very important, I mean, that, and I took care also of the courses and then distributed my course to the other students.
Do you think you is this a natural gift, do you think, to be able to just sort of take all this information and quickly?
And I was a teacher, I was teaching to my fellow students just out of interest and because I like to teach. And so that was long before I did, of course, think about any research. So I was just a teacher to explain the difficult parts in the courses, and especially chemistry, because the students struggled, certainly students in medicine, they had, you know, serious, let's say, aversion to chemistry.
Sure.
And I tried to overcome that, even already at that time. So later on it would become my profession.
So you made many friends, I assume, in medical school, people who appreciated
I think so, Yeah, I was, last year, I got a special recognition for that at our university. And so where the students referred to, those that are still alive, when they referred to how helpful I was in these old days. Yeah, that's... was a special recognition.
Yeah, that's nice. Yes.
No Nobel Prize, but, that was indeed a kind of, you know, satisfaction. Let's call it that way.
And how did you do with the other aspects of medical training? You know, there's dealing with people, with bodies, and so
that.
On.
became then a dilemma because that grew. I mean, I kept my preference for chemistry, but in the meantime, seeing patients, mm-hmm. I also felt very, let's say, attracted to do a medical career. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was thinking very seriously of starting to do internal medicine. And mm-hmm. and so then, at the end of my medical studies, there was a kind of an dispute, I would say, between two of my mentor professors, the professor of internal medicine, who wanted me to join his staff, and the professor, de Zomer, who was my real mentor in microbiology, who wanted me to join him. And then he came to me, he said, "We have found a solution. You are going to work 50% of your time with me on interferon, and 50% of your time you're going to see patients with my colleague internal medicine." And I said, "That's fantastic." But he was, of course, very smart, but he said, "You start first with me." And then, of course, he gave me then so many projects that I did not have the time to do the other 50% because I was already for 100% mm-hmm. working in microbiology mm-hmm. on interferon.
Yeah.
And I never went to the internal medicine. Mm-hmm. So it's...
So the years here, this is the late 60s.
That was in 1966.
Yeah, so interferon had been discovered about 10 years prior.
In 1957.
Right.
So by Isaacs and Lindemann. And Isaacs was even a good friend of my boss. But he passed away already in 1964. And de Zomer was very... Now I should talk a little about de Zomer. So Professor de Zomer was my real mentor. And he was very famous at that time in Leuven, at our place, in Belgium, actually, because he was also an MD, and he was very much attracted by penicillin. You must see the situation at that time. This I'm talking about the Second World War, where, I mean, there was a real big need for the penicillin production. I mean, the discovery of Fleming had taken place in 1929, but had then, you know, been very quiet around that. And it was rediscovered in 1940 by Florey and Chain. And then they got, for this big discovery of penicillin, the Nobel Prize in around 1945.
Yes, with Fleming.
With Fleming, yeah. And I still have the original transcripts of Fleming accepting the Nobel Prize.
That made an impact on you later? You came across that? And
oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, not directly at that time, but what was important, Professor de Zomer, I was at that time still, you know, young.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Just 10 years old or something. And Professor de Zomer was very much attracted by the discovery of penicillin. He was always attracted by big problems, you know, not small science, but really the biggest possible science. And penicillin had really fascinated him so much that at that time he started his career, that he built up a small company by the name of ORIT. This is Recherche Industrielle Thérapeutique, all in French, because you have to see the situation. Belgium was typically French. And he was able to get some money from venture capitalists. And
they probably weren't called venture capitalists.
At that time it was not called. No. His name was a certain Jacques Lanois. From the papeterie de Jeanval. So they were indeed not called venture capitalist, but he was, let's say, an entrepreneur. That's maybe a better word.
And this is unusual at this time. Is it or is it
very
not?
unusual? I mean, at these days, you must see this. This was at the end of the 40s. I'm talking now about 1948, 49, 50s. Yeah. I mean, so the Zomer, my boss, I mean, started as an entrepreneur in a company. He built up the company, mm-hmm. and he had no, at that time, no yet a connection with the university. He did this all just, he made perhaps some money as
he
well.
He was at the university but started this up and, yeah.
As an assistant at that time. He was not a professor yet.
Oh, okay.
So he started his company before he was a professor.
Oh, so this was already in place and running by the time you showed up at the university.
And, oh, yes.
Okay,
I was not there yet. mm-hmm. And... So, but this was a start.
Yeah, 48, 49, okay. Yeah.
Antibiotics. And that was then the company called RIT, Recherche Industrielle Thérapeutique.
I would just like to ask one other question about context. You're at this point where you have to make a decision about your future career, chemistry, medicine. And what were...
Well, at that time, I was not in research. And so the problem, you know, I'm talking about 1950, so I was only 9 years old.
So I mean later though, when you're...
Later on, and then what happened in the meantime, so the Zomer, mm-hmm. With that company that he had built up, then got a lot of money, a reasonable amount of money, with which he then built an institute. And that institute was called the Rega Institute. Mm. The name Rega, that's important, comes from an old figure, president of the university in the 18th century. Mm. And so it is a family name. It is not an abbreviation or an acronym mm-hmm. from, you know, Royal Evaluation or something like that. No, it was just a family name of a person that was quite famous in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And so the name was adopted to label the institute. Mm-hmm. And so the institute was built on the antibiotic money, on penicillin money, but then the Zomer got his second big love. That was the polio vaccine. You must realize polio in the 50s was a very huge problem.
Yeah.
And I can refer to a book on polio, an American problem, but that is because it was written by the American journalist Olitsky, who got a Pulitzer Prize for this. And I've read this story. So this was the time of Salk and Sabin. And so we had our local, let's say, interest. Professor de Zomer, of course, was not Salk or Sabin, but he was, let's say, the European equivalent, mm-hmm. since he was very much interested in developing then the polio vaccine.
Developing an independent vaccine?
Independent, and he was successful in doing this for the European continent. And I remember in these, then I had already joined the his group.
At the university?
At the university. And I never worked in a company, and I, at that time. And I remember the visit of Albert Sabin to our institute, because he became a friend of Professor de Zomer. And I was a very young assistant, so I had a big admiration, because Albert Sabin was a very towering kind of a figure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never seen Jonas Salk, but I know of the situation. And mm-hmm. and then de Zomer's, that was his second big love. He resolved the problem already in 1960. And
the problem of a vaccine?
Of the vaccine.
Yeah. How did he make it?
According to the method of Sabin.
Yeah, okay.
And so, yeah.
It was a live vaccine.
It was a live vaccine.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, you're very well informed in this. So, and so is that is the method he followed. And he was talking about that in his classes of microbiology. I was in the meantime proceeding to the fourth year and the fifth year. So we have 7 years of medical studies in our place. And I had to do exams with him. And then he was asking, because I was a good student, whether I could join his laboratory. And I said, no. I mean, I said, what should I have to work on? I said, viruses. I said, no, no viruses. It does not appeal to me. And I like formulas. Uh-huh. I like to do chemistry. And then he said, you can do the chemistry of viruses. But anyway, the first time that he asked me, I refused. But the year afterwards...
What did you have in mind? You said, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to do...
I wanted to do more biochemistry, fundamental work on biochemistry. I had no preconceived ideas, I mean, what exactly, but I wanted to see formulas, not viruses.
Right.
I mean, because viruses were...
Messy.
Kind of...
Yep. He wanted... Yeah.
And... not always in a good mood. I mean, whereas formulas are never changing their mood. So, but then when I talked to my colleagues, then they said, "But you have to be stupid to refuse an proposal of a man as important as Professor de Zomer, at that time he was going to be rector of his university. He was already advisor to the rector." And, you know, he was gaining more momentum.
Yeah, was there any problem in that? Is his ascent within the university, the fact that he had a commercial operation? Was that ever an issue?
No, that was, in fact, considered to be already a kind of a bonus point. Mm-hmm. I mean, the university accepted the fact that he had done industry first and then moved to the... let's say to the university, because when the institute was built, it was built with the money coming from industry.
So they were welcoming.
And they were welcoming, and on the founding stone, which is still present in our institute, that was, signed by the rector at that time, who was a Monseigneur, Magnificus. They were all priests, of course. Mm-hmm. And that was very well accepted. Mm-hmm. So it added to the, let's say, prestige.
Yeah.
Also, and to the situation of Professor de Zomer.
Right. Did the Rega family make any contribution to the institute, or is that just...
Only the name.
Yeah.
From Rega was chosen, but all the money came from industry. Mm-hmm. It was entirely devoted we got a lot of money, I think, I mean, in these old days. Mm-hmm. So I finally accepted then to come to work with Zomer, and he said, you're going to work on interferon. So, and that was the third love of Professor de Zomer after penicillin and other antibiotics, then the polio. But the polio problem was resolved, so he had then to switch to interferon. Mm-hmm. And his thinking was that interferon would become the kind of penicillin for virus infections. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was the belief, a panacea for resolving also the virus infections, as penicillin was believed to do this for bacterial infections. Mm-hmm. And that's when I joined and decided to join him, Professor de Zomer.
And what was your thought at that time, that this is a permanent move into research, to basic research, rather than a career in medicine?
Well, at that time, I was absolutely no. I just now realized that next year, it will be 50 years that I've joined the institute. So my career has already started in 64, in 1964.
Yeah, and you didn't even realize it.
And no, no, no. I just it's
at that time in Belgium. The what was the comparative stature of the medical profession and academic science, were in terms of maybe social prestige or remuneration? Were the was it an did it matter to you or did it matter to anybody else?
Well, I think normally to gain what all the money, or I mean reasonable amount of money, you had to do in private practice. And but the Zomer, his father, was a medical doctor, a physician, and a physician, not like in my case. And so, but he had seen, you know, this practice of his father, and he hated it. He did not want to see patients. So that was a big difference with me. I love patients, but he, in this case, he did not want to see patients. Mm-hmm. So he had decided to do research only and not to think about any patients. But normally to make enough money, research was very risky and you could fail. Whereas if you did a practice and seeing patients, you were always assured that you would never fail to get you know, sufficient amount of money.
Yeah. So it was a bit risky to go this way for you, personally?
It was a kind of risky, yes, and certainly for my mother, who had been dreaming to see her son become a practitioner, she was disappointed. And she has never forgiven Professor de Zomer for taking me away from, you know, this career.
Even with was she able to witness your wonderful success later?
No, my mother died before that happened. I mean, she has never seen it. No, well, and my wife even died later. But that's also part of the story. So then, what happened by 1966? I graduated as a medical doctor, and then I started to work in the laboratory of Professor de Zomer on interferon. And
what was known about interferon at that time?
At that time, interferon was really a very mysterious compound. It had not, of course, not been cloned, identified. Even the real chemists among my colleagues doubted very much that interferon existed.
Because you couldn't find enough pure interferon?
And that it was rather based on a principle, on what they called an antiviral state that interfered. That explains the name of interferon, that interfered with virus replication. So this is the belief at that time. And it's, of course, later on that it became identified. But at that time, it was really mysterious. And some of my colleagues, friends, they're... recommended that I should not continue on it, to work on interferon, because that was an unsettled, you know, compound. It was perhaps not even considered a compound, you know, but only a principle, and something that was in the air or something. You know, we are talking about the 1960s.
Did you have any doubts about it? We don't know what it is. We don't. Is there
I
such
doubts
a thing?
About it. I doubts about it. Yeah, I was not, let's say, so convinced that it really existed.
What about your mentor? Was he certain that it was there?
At that time, he believed that it existed, but then. You know, to make my belief stronger, he said, you have to go to the United States. You see, that was at that time considered to be the Mecca for further research, I mean, compared to the situation in Europe. So in all of Europe, also including Belgium, there was no, you know, what I would say, convincing place where to do real research, certainly not on interferon. Mm-hmm.
And now, at this time, you didn't have a doctorate or the equivalent of a doctorate in chemistry?
No, I never had. So I never pursued any degree in chemistry. No.
Oh, okay. In my notes here, somebody's identified you as a PhD. So that's
true. That I am. That I got later.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So, but the purpose of the Zomer was very clear. He said, "I send you overseas," and in retrospect, that was to consolidate that I would not, you know, get second thoughts, and that I would go straight in research. Mm-hmm. He gave me three options: is to work at Johns Hopkins.
And he knew people at all these places.
He knew because he had some contact persons at each place, and then the Bronx, that was Albert Einstein College in New York, and then the third option was Stanford. And of course, to work with Tom Merrigan, and I immediately selected Stanford.
And the idea of coming to the United States, is that something that had ever occurred to you before?
No, it really never occurred. But then I immediately realized it was unavoidable if I wanted to make a career.
And was it an exciting prospect?
It was, let's say, certain, but it became very exciting afterwards. And so my lifetime in Stanford, well, in the meantime, I got married. I mean, so with my wife, she was a pharmacist, and she liked the prospect of leaving Belgium and go to Stanford. Mm-hmm. And so she persuaded me to go there. So I got the fellowship.
She persuaded you to go to Stanford rather than Johns Hopkins or New
also,
York?
Yeah. I mean, because of the climate, I would say. And
What did you know about California at that time?
I did not know anything. Yeah. I mean, absolutely no.
Very different than Belgium.
Oh, yeah, totally different. It was, everything was a kind of serendipity. The choice of my wife, I mean, of to get married to her, and then to go for honeymoon. I mean, this was a honeymoon trip to California. Uh-huh. And I remember that trip even. I mean, it was with Pan Am, no longer exist, and we had to fly first to London, then a very big flight to Los Angeles, then from Los Angeles to San Francisco, then from San Francisco by helicopter to Palo Alto.
Helicopter?
Yeah. It probably does not exist anymore, but I remember the last part, I mean, was per helicopter. And we arrived around in the morning, but local time was evening here. And the phone was ringing, and this was, that is typical, that was the wife of my boss here, Tom American. And she gave me instructions in a Californian dialect, and I did not understand one word. One word, no. So the beginning was rather, what I would say...
A little awkward.
Awkward, yeah. And so my wife was asking what she said, and I said, the only thing I know, it is Joan. Her name is Joan, but that I knew before. But what she said, she's saying something about what's going to happen next morning, and about brown hashed potatoes. I said, I never heard. I do not know about all this. I mean, so for us, it was really an adventure. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, Stanford was, honestly, was like, compared to Belgium, of compared to our institute, was like a heaven on earth. I mean, what was possible here, what was not possible in Leuven, that's tremendous.
And I mean, and why is that? What was that at Stanford? Was it people? Knowledge?
The people, the and the intellect, and the drive. That was so much easier here than in Belgium. Everything was complicated. Even if we had to ask for the smallest things, here at Stanford, I mean, you just got, they got a lot of money, but they also got a lot of intellect. And for me, it was like falling into heaven, scientifically. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had the pleasure of attending the lectures of the biochemists.
Paul Berg, Kornberg.
And the whole became, and Paul Berg is still my friend now, but at that time, yes, I mean, I was, and I went over to hear, especially was Archer Kornberg, was the leader of the group. I mean, he was a very good teacher. And I followed all his lessons just as a free student. I did not have at that time the foreseen the time to do a PhD in 1 year, because that's my fellowship was only for 1 year, and they told me at Stanford that in 1 year I could not really enroll for a PhD degree, but I said, but I followed the lessons, and that were very stimulating lessons. I mean, in these old days, I mean, with Kornberg and Berg, I've also met Lederberg at sometimes, but not regularly. But so all those were Nobel Prizes.
Right, and they're working on DNA at that time.
And the DNA polymerase, on, yeah. I mean, it's... and of course, I was not working on DNA polymerase because I was working on interferon and interferon induction with Merrigan. So I just followed them and their classes out of interest. That was, but it was for me like so much refreshing, opening the real world.
And you had a sense that this is the center of the universe for the entire field?
Biochemistry, yeah. Stanford was officially, I think, the best place. Mm-hmm. I guess in the United States, that means by definition in the whole world. So yes, it was the best place. Mm-hmm. That is for sure. Mm-hmm. I do not know how it evolved later, but and so after 1 year, I liked it so much that I asked permission to my boss, Professor De Zomer, whether I could stay for another 1 year. And he said yes, but no more. Then
he wants you to come back and help him.
Yeah. And. And then my wife, she liked it even more than, you know, living at Stanford, and she wanted to stay there. And my boss at Stanford, Tom Merrigan, offered me a position of doing the clinical virology. Mm-hmm. And when I told this to my boss, De Zomer, he flew over directly to see me and said, "You have to come back. Now it's..." and so I stayed for a few more months after the second year, but no longer than that.
Well, how did you feel about that? Did you have conflicted loyalties, or did...
Yeah. Well, my parents liked to see me back, and then Professor De Zomer liked to see me back, and so I made a decision to come back, and it was a hard time.
Yeah.
It was a hard time because for at least 6 months, I had a very hard time to get acclimatized again to Belgium. Because Belgium had not changed, and our institute had not changed. And I missed the intellect and the lectures, the many lectures that the people came to, because Stanford was, of course, a pole of attraction for the whole world. I mean, everybody wanted to come to Stanford to give lectures there. Mm-hmm. And I attended many of these lectures of famous people from the whole world. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, as soon as I was back in Belgium, that disappeared. I mean, but I knew I had to, come back and to start a career at home. Mm-hmm. And that is then the first thing I did was to get my PhD. That was based on the work I'd done at Stanford and the work I'd done in Leuven, so it was a combination. So in 1972, I got the PhD, but also in Leuven, just as my MD. Mm-hmm. So I never got a PhD from Stanford, yeah. No.
What was your PhD thesis on? What had you learned about interferon?
That was induction of interferon. So half of that was based on the work at Stanford, half of it was based on the work at in Leuven. Mm-hmm. And Professor De Zomer was my, of course, thesis advisor. Tom Merrigan was... No, he did not come over for my thesis defense. That's right. But he was my boss here at the Stanford University. Mm-hmm. He is still alive. He's around 78. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is still alive in Portola Valley, I believe. It
is. Which is a beautiful place.
Yeah, well, yeah. I always lived beautifully. Mm-hmm. So that was my Stanford days, I have very good memories of that. Mm-hmm. And then I started to build up my own career, because then the Zomer very quickly told me that I could do whatever I like to do.
Did you leave interferon at that point?
And not at that point yet. Mm-hmm. Later on I would leave it. But I continued to work on interferon. And I picked up a second, love at that time. That was the reverse transcriptase. I remember when, at the end of my stay at Stanford, I spotted in Nature the papers that were published by Mizutani and Temin, and then another paper that was published by Baltimore. I found that fantastic. I mean, this had nothing to do with interferon, but I was, very fascinated by these discoveries.
Well, did you think this could help explain viruses and maybe the action of interferon somehow? Or?
Did not see a connection with interferon, but I saw a connection with cancer.
Yeah.
And my dream was always to find a cure for cancer. You see, I did not fulfill this dream. But let's say that was, and the reverse transcriptase at that moment was considered to be at the origin of cancer. So that brings us to some papers that were published by a certain Saul Spiegelman, based on the Temin and Baltimore discovery, mm-hmm. that the reverse transcriptase was on the basis of cancer. That was in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Now we know, of course, much better, but this was the belief in that. And I could even give you an anecdote to confirm the belief in there, because totally on my own, without having said anything about it to anybody else, I discovered that a certain compound, which was known by the name of suramine, was a very good inhibitor of the reverse transcriptase. I done this with my own hands. So, no, I did not have a technician. I did not even tell my boss about it. So I kept
that. What put you onto it? How did you make the discovery?
That was just by serendipity that I had found. I was going through the shelf, let's say. And in fact, the name of the compound, suramine, was Moranil. That was the French name. In Germany, it was Germanin. I mean, since suramine had been used in the old days for sleeping sickness. And so I, totally by chance, I found that this was inhibiting the reverse transcriptase. So the belief was, that was around 1975, that could be a cure for cancer. So believe it or not, I was injecting leukemic cells in mice, treating them with suramine, with the belief that as an inhibitor of the reverse transcriptase, that would stop leukemia. Mm-hmm. But it did not. I mean, and I was very disappointed. Otherwise, I could have told my boss, look, I have fulfilled your dream to find a cure for cancer.
Yeah.
And no, I did not, I could not tell anybody. And I buried the data, classified the data, until 1978, when Bob Gallo, this is an authentic story, visited me. And Gallo, he was very curious about what I was doing and about, you know. And I told him.
He knew about you and your work.
He somehow knew about me. Mm-hmm. And I told him that I had discovered that suramine was a very good inhibitor of the reverse transcriptase. That was firm. And but that it did not have any effect on cancer or on leukemia. And that for that reason, I thought that this was not publishable. And he said, yeah, but you should publish. I mean, in my journal, Cancer Letters, on the suramine, not for leukemia, but for its effect against reverse transcriptase. Maybe one day it will be picked up. And in fact, years later, after HIV had been discovered, then suramine was the first.
That Gallo tried?
That Gallo tried. Mm-hmm. And I was not told. And in fact, I got at a certain time a phone call at home from some brother who was working with Gallo at the National Cancer Institute. And some brother, he congratulated me on suramine. And I said, well, I forgot all about it. What did you find? And the reason that he congratulated me, actually he congratulated himself, because his paper in Science was just accepted. and that was in 1984, and it was on the inhibition of HIV replication. Later on, it was shown that actually suramine worked more by blocking the entry of the virus into the cells rather than the reverse transcriptase. But at least the reason that I tested it against HIV was based on my data.
But it did inhibit reverse transcriptase?
It did, yes. Yeah. But that is quite often in science. You find A and B, and you always try to causally link these two things. Mm-hmm. But quite often they are just by accident.
Right.
Yeah. By accident. And that happened in this case. Mm-hmm. And but for me, it gave me, of course, a satisfaction. And you can see the name of Bob Gallo on that paper, mm-hmm. which was then with some brother was on the paper, and then Mitsuya, Hiroaki Mitsuya, who had done the experiments with HIV. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I was very attracted. And then some brother, even on the phone, invited me to come to work at NCI. But at that time, I mean, I'm talking about 1983, 1984.
Had you in the 70s, had you started working on retroviruses?
Actually, yes. I already worked on retroviruses at Stanford. Because I had developed a system with based on Mollony sarcoma virus to induce tumors in mice. Mm-hmm. I had done that at Stanford. Mm-hmm. And, of course, then I brought the system with me, and we further worked with that model in Leuven. Mm-hmm. But that was a murine leukemic virus, and not with the human. I mean, it's... because then Gallo, I mean, described the first human TLV, the TLV1, but that is the system that I never worked with. I mean, so we worked with the murine system. Mm-hmm. So we worked with it, but unfortunately, I mean, I tested some of the reverse transcriptase inhibitors in that system, but not suramine. I mean, so somehow after it did not have an anti-leukemic effect, I somehow forgot about it and did never further explore it. And AZT I explored in these days, but not against leukemic viruses. Otherwise, we should have discovered it. Mm-hmm. So let's say that I missed some very important discoveries. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going in too many different directions. So
okay, sure.
I was back, and it was already clear that I would never go back to Stanford or to the United States, because at that time I got also more and more interested in small molecules as antivirals, because always my inclination to work on you know, on molecules rather than interferon. Mm-hmm. Now, interferon, I'd not given up on it, because, you know, it must have existed since, you know, the group of Maurice Hilleman at Merck had tried to purify and were able to purify it to a certain stage. Mm-hmm. So that was evidence that interferon existed. Mm-hmm. And then there was a second big breakthrough in the interferon field, is that you could induce it with double-stranded RNA. Mm. So from then on, I became convinced that this molecule really existed. I talked about it with a man in the University of Ghent, Walter Fiers, who had also spent some time at Stanford. And in the group of the biochemistry. And Walter Fiers, you know, he is a real brain. I mean, he believed in the existence of interferon, and he said, we are going to clone it and to express it and so on. And so in a collaboration between three groups, Fiers, then my own group, and then also the group of Jean Contant at the Pasteur Institute, that is in Brussels, we succeeded in 1980 in cloning interferon beta, the beta interferon, and in expressing it. We were not the first for interferon, because that was then alpha.
Fiers, yeah, was Fiers involved with that? Because he was also in Biogen with Weissman.
He was at Biogen, yes. That is, but he, I never knew about these precise links with Biogen. I mean, my role in this here was just to express, to induce interferon with double-stranded RNA. Mm-hmm. That was the big breakthrough for the double-stranded RNA, poly-I, poly-C, as we called it. And that was a breakthrough that was made at Merck. And so we used this technology to induce enough of the messenger RNA, then we were able to extract the messenger RNA. That work was done by the help of Jean Contant in Brussels. And then at, in Ghent, then they produced interferon starting from the messenger RNA, and then we again tested the production of interferon with this system. So it was really a collaboration that was going. Fiers, in some of his slides, had presented it as a train that was going like always like that, but it was not really a train, it was a car who was always driving between these three places. But we were the first for the beta interferon, whereas Weissman had done it for the alpha interferon. So we were only by a few months we were second. Mm-hmm. But these were hectic days because, you know, we prepared two Nature papers on this, and so the Fierce was in continuous correspondence with the office at Nature, I mean, and so, and we got two papers in 1980. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was also a little bit the end of the story, because then, as a side product, we also found the beta 2 interferon, also produced in the same system, and beta 2 interferon later on became IL 6, interleukin 6. So that was a co-discovery, or let's say, an co-product mm-hmm. of the beta interferon. Mm-hmm. And then.
But that was your last involvement with the interferon?
And it was my last involvement, and there were two reasons for that. Is that in the meantime, I got too much involved in the small molecules, in the world of the, and already was, let's say, starting to discover new compounds there. Yeah. And second, the Zomer himself had lost his belief in interferon. So, he, and...
Just when the rest of the world is...
Well,
there's a lot of hype about interferon at that time.
At that time, there was a lot of hype. There was a certain time, there was a belief that interferon would have an anti-cancer activity. But, you know, we never believed in this. And as you can see also, this has not been followed up. Mm-hmm. And then the Zomer, I mean, at a certain moment, like all big inventors, injected once interferon by himself.
Did he get sick?
And he got a very big, a Schwarzman reaction, allergic reaction.
Yeah.
And then he said, what an awfully toxic compound. So that is never going to make to be a drug. And he lost his belief. Mm-hmm. And he did not make... let's say many people could friends with it, but, you know, because mm-hmm. he officially at the meeting, and I think it was in Reovod, at the Weizmann Institute in Reovod, he once officially declared that he had lost his belief in interferon mm-hmm. at an interferon meeting. Mm-hmm. That was like, you know,
yeah.
What do you call that? Insulting the church.
Right. Yeah.
So it's. But anyway, I had also at the same time lost my belief in interferon and working with new molecules.
And did you think it made sense to work with small molecules rather than big macromolecules?
Sure. Well, that was the reason also that I was working with polynucleotides to induce interferon, but then. If interferon would not be useful, then inducers of interferon will not be useful either. Mm-hmm. And also for the chemists that I collaborated with, it was a relief that they learned that they did not have to produce huge molecules, that small molecules may do the job. So that is the reason why I shifted also interest from larger molecules to the smaller ones. Mm-hmm. And so then I drifted away totally from the work that I had initiated mm-hmm. At Stanford and went my own way to collaborate with many chemists all over the world. So it's something that I also announced yesterday in my talk. The biggest discovery that I've ever made was that I discovered the chemists. And the chemists would make the compounds for me. That's, mm-hmm. So it is a boutade, or of course it's. And if I would say the chemist, then I would single out one chemist, and that is Anthony Holy. I mean, so.
Yeah.
A compatriot of Mendel. Mm-hmm. And.
Did you meet him at this time?
That was in 1976.
Oh, early.
Already at that time. I had already collaborations with a few other chemists over the world, including David Sugar. That was that was in Warsaw, in Poland, with Fritz Eckstein. That was at the Institute of Biophysicalische and Chemie, or Medicine Chemie, because you have two Max Plancks in Göttingen. That was the Max Planck for Medicinale and Chemie, and the other one is Biophysicalische and Chemie. But then, based on my work on interferon induction, I was invited at a meeting, a rather small symposium, in Göttingen of the Biophysicalische Chemie, of the Max Planck Institute of Biophysicalische Chemie. And there, I think, I made this big discovery of being an MD, to be there with only chemists. So I must have thought of me that is, what is this MD doing here? He probably lost his way. and that is where I met for the first time also Dr. Holy. Mm-hmm. You must see this in the situation at that time. This was the Iron Curtain. Mm-hmm. I mean, he came from the Czechoslovak Academy of Sciences in Prague. And there were a few other, and these were also American chemists there. I mean, John Moffat was there, John Montgomery. These were very big names in the nucleoside chemistry. And also, of course, a few West Germans with the name of Pfleiderer and also Forbruggen. And these were giants in their field. And they, incidentally, they are still alive. And and I was there, the only MD that had lost his way among all these chemists. That is where I arranged with Holy that we should work on small molecules and to see whether we could, that were anti-metabolites, whether we could get them to work against the viruses. So that is how I made my first arrangement. And Holy, as a person, was in the beginning rather suspicious, because he was like, you know, the others, they say, what is this MD coming to do here? I mean, he is to steal our compounds or what?
But you explain to people, no, I've been at Stanford.
Well, at least I could speak their language. I mean, and I could understand the formulas. So this were not like for many other MDs, things that only existed, with formula. I enjoyed formulas. I've always, and still do. I mean, and that is... let's say that I have a chemical mind, and that made me to understand the chemists. So we could talk. I mean, and what made me perhaps attractive for them is I could explain diseases. So that made them a little bit at ease.
And had Holy been doing anything with antiviral chemistry? Or is this something completely new that you're introducing to or proposing to him?
Some existed. I think I'm talking about 1976. We had, at that time, we had three or four antiviral compounds that had been described. IDU had been described, TFT had been described, then ribavirin had been described, and... that was in 1976. There was the first clinical report on the activity of ARA-A, fidarabine. But this is it. These were only four. That's it. And so there was no much belief that viral infections could be cured by anything. Certainly not by antivirals. Still, the belief was interferon would do it.
Yeah, because that's the natural role of interferon.
But
if there, yeah.
Incidentally, it was just in 1976 that Whitley published for the first time the use of vidarabin, or RAE, in the treatment of herpes zoster. That was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1976. Mm-hmm. And that was the very first. Mm-hmm.
But did you have to persuade Holy that this is something, this is a good way to go? Come, let's work together on this? Did he say, well, I don't believe this?
No, it started very cautiously. He wanted to test me. So he sent me only three compounds. And he said, do it with these three compounds and then see what happened. And if anything, let's decide what you find with these three compounds.
How were the compounds selected?
Just at random. And in fact, the two compounds that he thought would be effective were not. And the one compound that he thought would be ineffective was effective. And believe it or not, that only one compound, it was called DHPA, that compound, we published on that in Science in 1978. Mm-hmm. Only one out of three compounds. Mm-hmm. And we published only on that compound because the two others were inactive. Mm-hmm. And when we published it, it was at that time a direct, let's say, competition with acyclovir, because the Wellcome laboratories had just published a few months before we published on this in Science of another compound that was somewhat similar. Well, I'm not going to explain all the differences in chemistry, but was somewhat similar, and that became acyclovir later. And this was the work actually with Trudy Allion, for which and for other work she got together with George Itchings in 88. She got the Nobel Prize. Mm-hmm. But so acyclovir was the major discovery, and that changed the antiviral field. I mean, and that was a discovery that was made in 1977 or 78. I mean, there were two papers. One was published in the PNAS, and the other paper was published in Nature a few months later, that explained the activity. So we were then with another compound just a few months after that, also in 1978, and that we were able to publish in Science. Mm-hmm. And that was together with Holy. Mm-hmm. And so...
Did you have a big group at your place?
No.
No?
Oh, I did this all by myself.
Yes.
With a technician.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
Only one technician. Mm-hmm. Later on, my group would grow up to 40 people, but at that time, no. It was only one technician.
There just weren't resources for that. You didn't have the work being done on that scale in Belgium at that time?
That was not even...
Yeah.
I was the only one that ever had touched the antiviral field. So there was... No, my only, competition was in the U.S. I mean, acyclovir was discovered in the U.K. and the U.S., I mean, because Wellcome laboratories were at both places, in the U.S. and the U.K. Mm-hmm. So originally, I mean, to give credit to those that deserve it, it was done in the U.K. Mm-hmm. So interferon was U.K., penicillin was the U.K., I'm not British, but you have to give, honesty, but it is due. So the discovery of the antiviral activity of acyclovir was done in the laboratories of Wellcome in the UK, and then they sent it for further exploration for mechanism of action and so to the US.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So, but... that is off the record.
So the 1978 paper, then this is, you've got some success, and this for you is, it's recognition, oh, we're on the right track, there's something
something to pursue here.
That is true. I mean, then we resolved the mechanism of action. And Holy himself was more enthusiastic about this compound, so that he commercialized it even in the Czechoslovak Republic. Hmm. So that was his first compound. And now it is off the market. I mean, it's no longer on the market, but it was with a local Czechoslovak company that did not longer exist, and it was used for fever blisters. It's, but it was the beginning. It was the beginning. Then came really the major breakthrough was around 1985. 1985, that is when we discovered the principle of the phosphonates. And that is brings us back to the chemistry. In a normal nucleotide, analog, you have a phosphate group attached to the sugar ring with an what is called POC bond. POC means phosphor, oxygen, carbon. Now that is an ester bond. So when it comes to let's say metabolism in the cells in the organism, that is easily cleaved, because the phosphate group is cleaved at the level of the POC with water, and then you split off the phosphate group. So the real discovery of Holy was that he had replaced the POC by a PCO, where you have a direct linkage between the phosphorus and the carbon.
And that's a more durable bond?
And that is stable as a rock, and cannot be cleaved by water, cannot be cleaved spontaneously, cannot be cleaved enzymatically. So you would say that's very simple, but that is actually the crux of the story.
How did he make the discovery?
He was not the first one, because the PCO technically or chemically was also known by others.
I see.
But he was the first to apply this to a group of compounds that were isosteric to nucleotides. So, and that is, or to those that can be used in a normal metabolism. So it had been synthesized, so Holy never was the first, of course, but...
But he was the first in...
In the nucleotide business.
Yes.
So let's...
And which was not well developed, so
and
nobody
that
had...
Been,
yeah.
So that was a real discovery, that not what you could call something that would, others would find. No, he was, let's say, the first one to do it there. My contribution has been only secondary to his... I mean, because he synthesized it, and I recognized it. And I then applied it and made it useful in terms of applications. So I could immediately see that this could lead to a lot of, well, I did not claim I could see this, but let's say that gradually, then we were able to show it that it worked in these very different conditions.
And where did you start?
We first start to see whether it was active against herpes simplex virus, the easier virus. By that time, we had, of course, also HIV. From then on, we had the HIV system. So then we immediately realized that it was also active against HIV, and then later on we extended it to hepatitis B and to other DNA viruses.
And the mechanism of action in each case is similar?
It is always based on that same principle. The compound is built in into the DNA and cannot be cleaved anymore because of the presence of the phosphonate. So it is a rather simple principle. And the fact is that you could ask, why is it only active against DNA viruses, not RNA viruses, or not DNA of the cells? That is even not an all or none phenomenon, but it is in the DNA of the viruses, there is a much faster turnover, so you get a profitable, let's say, attack on the virus as compared to the cells. That is the idea that has been growing, of course, for all these years. Now, the first compound in this series was a compound which we called HPMPA, and that is the compound which was never commercialized because it was considered to be too toxic.
You had found that? Or had you tested it?
At that time, we did not know about the toxicity, but finally, because of toxicity, it was not I'm talking about the long run. But the principle was published, and that was published in Nature. And so that has become our standard paper, published in 1986 in Nature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I believe that I sent that paper first to Science.
What were their objections to it?
Oh, lack of space. Okay. If they had objections, it's too many papers, too much, let's say, pressure for publication.
Mm-hmm. I see.
But Nature accepted it, and of course, you know, it has become the standard of principles, and later on we published, of course, many, many more papers on this. Mm-hmm. I must never lose it.
A few more minutes, yeah?
Okay, no, till 11 it's okay. Okay, because it takes longer to return for me since I'm going so slowly, so it's... it's what I would say the most fascinating part is the beginning. Now then, the question that you would ask, you realize how I got in touch with Holy, how did Gilead involved? So this is a very interesting part, because at this moment Gilead did not exist yet.
Gilead was founded in 1987.
By a certain man, Michael Rorden, with the help of Rumsfeld.
Oh, right.
Yeah. You probably know that. Mm-hmm. In 1987. So, but what happened is, in these old days, there was kind of a compound hunter by the name of Julius Vida, and that came once to our laboratory in 1985, and he asked me about whether I had any compounds. He was from Bristol-Myers. Whether I had any compounds that could be of interest for development. I was very careful of not getting involved with such techniques of companies.
No, why not?
Why not? Because, you know, I was in an academic institute and not eager to jump into contracts with companies.
But there was some history at your university.
That was helpful. In 1985, what had happened is that Zomer had died early this year, but so I had this legacy of making contacts. He told me when to make a contact, you know, I had to be very careful. So, and I told to this man called Julius Vida that I had probably a compound that I could be interested in. But then I said, this compound is not mine. This has been synthesized in Prague.
Yeah.
And now I did not know that Julius could speak Czech, because he was actually a Czech. And he said, no problem.
Did he know about Holy?
No, not. I told him much later. And then he asked me again. I told him about the potential of this class of compounds, and that meant that he had to travel to Prague to get in contact with, because I was not going to sell compounds from Holy without telling anybody. But then he also told at home at Bristol-Myers to the director of research, and that was a certain John Martin. And so John Martin was the first one to be informed by Julius Vida. And then John invited me to come over to give talks at Bristol-Myers. He visited me. He then went on further to Prague.
He must have been very young at that time.
At that time, yeah. Sure, I still have the pictures. Or young, because he had just been at, and that's probably what you do not have covered, I think, in your reports. He was at Syntax. He started his career with a certain Julian Verheyden, also Belgian origin, at Syntax. And he was the one who discovered ganciclovir. And then he moved over to Bristol-Myers. And so then at Bristol-Myers, he was very much attracted by this compound, by the what I call the Holy's compounds, and was immediately very much interested. And then at Bristol-Myers, they signed up a lot of papers, I mean with us, that they were going to develop it, and the one that was responsible for the development would be John Martin, and all at Bristol-Myers. What changed the situation in 1990, that is that Squibb moved in, and actually Squibb took over Bristol-Myers. And so from then on, it was BMS. And the first thing that John Martin realized, that is that he was going to lose his job as director at this new company, BMS. And he quit in 1990. And
So how far had this gone? Did Bristol-Myers, did they had control of the compounds at this point, or not?
Bristol-Myers had complete control of the compound. Yeah, that signed, and that was all signed by Julius Vida. And so there, you know, it was easy for me because I signed always immediately, but and people in Prague were very suspicious.
Government people or university?
No, the lawyers, the attorneys there, and that took, I mean, and I had to study this agreement very carefully, so that took months and months.
Is that because, do you think they didn't have experience with this kind of transaction, or?
Well, the thing is, they considered Bristol-Myers as an imperialist company, coming from an imperialist country. And without telling me, they were preferring to have deals with the Germans, in this case with Oegst. And Oegst once invited me to talk about these compounds, and I figured out that they knew more about it than I did. So the reason was very simple, because the people in Prague had contacted Oegst and had told them all the secrecies about this.
So, and had Holy been in contact with them?
And Holy, of course, was involved. And then I said, you know, you cannot continue like that. I mean, you cannot continue with Bristol-Myers and with Oegst. And I told that to the people at Oegst too, and I said, you know, I mean, this is, they're playing on two horses. I mean, so in the Czech Republic, I mean, you cannot continue like that. Or they can, and then they stopped. And Oegst later on disappeared from the scene. But, you know, it's good that they stopped, so they continued with Bristol-Myers.
Yeah, why did they go one way rather than the other? Do you have any notion of that?
Why? No, that I do not know.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, no, that was also because maybe the situation at Oaks was not very clear, and you know that they were going to be taken over themselves by other companies. So that was you know, you come in at a kind of a treadmill of company management and company business that you know, for a poor scientist cannot evaluate.
Right. So yeah.
Anyway, the Oaks business was stopped, and so all the papers were then further done to Bristol-Myers, and so then John got his offer to become vice president of Bristol-Myers. Of Gilead.
Did you hear about that after the fact, or?
Yes, after that, Gilead had independently already contacted me for a collaboration before that. But that is, but that had nothing to do with these phosphonates.
It was the antisense?
That was antisense, but I would collaborate with them on antisense. But
What did you know about antisense? Had you worked, done any work? And
No, I never really. I followed a little about the antisense, but I never worked on the antisense. So it is. I was not interested, and I did not see any druggable approach in that. I wanted to see drugs.
Why did you think the antisense wouldn't work? You couldn't deliver the oligonucleotide?
That is because of delivery problems. Yeah. You could not get them to the target. So it is a simple reasoning, but working with polynucleotides, I knew that making antisense, or making drugs out of antisense, would be a terrible, difficult problem.
Well, it's difficult. I'm going to talk tomorrow. I'm going to talk to Stanley Crook down in San Diego.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know him, Mr.
Do you?
Yeah.
I haven't met him. Yeah.
It's a long time ago that I've seen him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've even played tennis once.
Is that right?
Yeah. But no, I do not do that anymore. But that is, at that time, that was how Gilead started. But then John Martin was hired as their vice president, and at that time the compounds were in the hands of Bristol-Myers. So for a year we were in a very difficult situation, that the champion of working with the phosphonates was already going over to Gilead, whereas the compounds were still at Bristol-Myers Squibb at that time. And so at Bristol-Myers Squibb, that was in 91, in May, they invited Holy and myself to come to Wallingford at their headquarters, where they were going to tell us how they saw the future of this compound. So we, Holy and I, were in a good mood. I mean, you say, now we are going to find out what they are going to do with it. And as it is normal, when we come over to the U.S., they treat us with a dinner. That is always the day before.
Is that not the custom? Is that the custom elsewhere?
And that evening, I mean, I remember, I mean, it was around 11, just we went eating the dessert. And Julius Vida said, well, I have to tell you guys, he was talking to Holy and myself, tomorrow you are going to hear how Bristol-Myers Squibb is seeing the future. But that's not very bright. They are going to return the company.
To
the owners, in this case, to John, Tony Holy and myself.
That's good news, yeah.
Well, but we were, of course, that was good news in a certain way. I mean,
yeah.
If you look at it from today, I mean, it was good news.
You were hoping to hear that they were going to put a lot of resources into.
And that they were going to put a lot of resources and going to develop it and so on. And they had told us, I mean, we are closing the books.
Why did they bring you to dinner and to the U.S.? As courteous, at least.
Yeah, I think so. Well, and the man who was responsible for that was Ulf. I mean, apparently I heard about the story from Julius Vida later on. There was a split voting for it. It was something like 3-3. And then, since it was 7 in total to vote, then the last vote was against it. And Julius said, you know, I'm not responsible. I mean, I voted for it, but they did not accept it. So Bill Scott, the one from Bristol-Myers Squibb, voted against it. And within 1 week, John Martin was already calling us. He said, what did I hear? I mean, the bad news. And it's like you said, it's rather good news, he said, for us, because now we offer you the situation that you transfer the whole package of all these compounds, but of the deal that you had with Bristol Myers, now to Gilead. And then we had a meeting in July. In the meantime, the disapproval of the compounds was on the in May. By the 2nd of July, we had a meeting which I consider still as the most historical meeting that I ever had. Was in Paris, and was at somewhere on the street in the Best Western, where we were with four, and John Martin, his boss at that time, that was Michael Rorden, and it was the one that had created Gilead, and then Tony Holy and myself. Mm-hmm. So I had to interrupt my examination.
I think we have a photo with the four of you together.
So. I do not even. But that was not at that meeting.
Yeah, but later.
That was
later. Much later.
I always consider this like, equivalent to Yalta in the Second World War. But in Yalta, they separated East and West. Here, they united East mm-hmm. and West. And so at that memorable day, I mean, we signed, Holy and I signed the agreement with Gilead.
And were the terms as good as the terms you had with Bristol Myers?
They were exactly the same. So that was the easiest. And Tony and I, we discussed it, and I said, well, we take a big risk, because now we are going from a very big company, Bristol Myers, to an unknown company, biotech company. I mean, we did not know what that was going to give.
Well, was it faith in John Martin?
It was faith in John Martin. I think he was the main reason. Yeah. Well, no, I'm cutting the story short in the sense that then Mike Rorden has stayed with the company till around 1986. I think, 96? Till around 96, yeah. 97.
This was 91 where...
This was 90. The deal in agreement in Paris was in 91. And then, I must say that for Gilead, this was a question of survival. For us, it was a real blessing to know that Gilead really pushed so hard. But they did not have an alternative. You know, they had the antisense, but for them, that was not going to make any sense. And
But they maintained that program for some time.
For some time, but not for much longer. Yeah. And as soon as they had, faith in the phosphonate, then they rejected the antisense.
And I think they sold it to Stanley Cook.
Yeah. Well,
I think so. is that right? I think. I have to check, but I think it went to ISIS.
That may have happened later, but they had a deal with Glaxo on the originally on the antisense, and then they stopped that deal. And then later on, they may have a deal with ISIS to.
I think they did. They sold the patents.
But then they really devoted, and I must say, this is real the genial. Approach of John Martin with Norbert Biskoberger. I think they've always formed and are still forming a very good team.
Did he come from Bristol Myers as well?
No. John brought some other colleagues like Mick Hitchcock and also Moose Mazzuri. He brought them to followed John Martin from Bristol Myers to Gilead. But independently, Norbert came from Genentech. So he was a Genentech. So they were not linked. Only linked
Gilead
when they were there. Mm-hmm. And then I have been there numerous times. I mean, I do not know how many times, but at least twice a year. I've been at Gilead. And in the beginning, I mean, this was very tough. I mean, to push these compounds to the market. Mm. So that was a long process. Mm-hmm. So it's, and of course, I mean, it has only been increasing now in terms of, let's say, intensity. Mm-hmm. But based on the phosphonates, let's call it the phosphonate groups, they have enlarged from 20 people up to 3,000 people or 4,000 people.
Yeah.
So that's so I did not create this company, but let's see that I played a major role in getting this company up, mm-hmm. up to the certain to this stage. Mm-hmm. So what do we have at this moment? I mean, we have a total of 8 compounds, that or 7 compounds.
How many were there originally that went that were transferred from Bristol Myers to Gilead? How many at that time?
Oh, there was no compound yet. No, we only had the at that time the technology. Yeah. We had the first one that we had coming along was Zidovovir, and Zidovovir wasn't the first to be officially licensed in 1996.
Yeah.
So that was the first.
Right.
The second one was actually Adefovir. That was finally then licensed in 2001. And then Tenofovir came in 2000. And that was then further pursued in combinations.
Mm-hmm.
So then in 2004, we had Truvada. That was approved. Then in 2006 we had Atripla. In 2011, now I'm already speaking about the recent times, we had Complera, which is on the market also in the European Union as Eviplera. And then we had in 2012 we have had Stribilt, that is the latest one, and also in 2012, ironically at the day that Tony Holy died, 16th of July, we had Truvada approved for prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, and a few other combinations are still coming. The new compound, the new, let's say, tenofovir is tough for tenofovir alafenamide, and that is scheduled for next year or the year afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
This is all in terms of the original agreement that says that we should also be entitled for prodrugs of not only the phosphonate compounds, but also for the products, and that is the that may be synthesized, let's say, by the company.
Mm-hmm.
So that was also transferred. So let's say that we got also good, let's say, agreement on this
that
approach,
and that helped immensely in Belgium, yeah, with research at the university.
Well, let's say that based on this deal, we are entitled to royalties.
Yes.
And so, but the royalties are going to the university.
Yeah.
Not to the inventors.
Right.
It's different in Prague.
Ah.
So there the royalties are in the first place going to the inventor, and he has an agreement then with And I do not know how this has now been restructured, now sure. that Julia died. But then this is an agreement that he has with the academy or the institute. In our case, all the royalties are going straight to the university. Mm-hmm. And then I must make an agreement with the university to get part of the royalties to myself, mm-hmm. which has been... let's say up till last year it was not settled, but you see these things take sometimes mm-hmm. for a long time mm-hmm. and but anyway I mean this is now settled, so
good.
And
it's, yeah,
so I've so far not become a rich man on that. I mean there are people that have become rich, but that was not
the objective.
That was not the objective.
But, and how did after the 90s, in early 90s, these compounds go under development at Gilead, and how does your work progress in Belgium in your lab?
Well, let's say that all the efforts then from the 2000, I think, was done at Gilead. And we have continued to use some of the money, of course, that are getting from this deal, I mean, to do our research.
Yeah.
Not on these compounds anymore, because
right.
that is finished.
Right.
I mean,
so what have you been working on?
Well, let's say on... I personally cannot work anymore. Since the rule
has a mandatory
at
age,
60
yeah.
at the age of 65, which uh-huh. is already a few years ago. I uh-huh. mean, since 2006, so it is going to the laboratory and our many different projects. I mm-hmm. mean, so mm-hmm. I cannot work anymore. I mean, I can still write, and I still do write, and I can still teach, but not in Belgium. So I keep teaching in, just ironically, in the Czech Republic. So mm-hmm. Where I found another very good friend. I mean, actually he was also friend of Tony Holy, is a certain Libor Grubhofer, and he is the now the rector, president of the University of České Budějovice. And that's where I get this stuff. In a place called České Budějovice, which is south of Prague. It's about 2 hours' drive from Prague. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you have ever had the occasion to visit, well, to visit me, and also to visit him, I mean, that would be great. I mean, you would be very well received there. Mm-hmm. Because... these are places where people do not come. I mean, this is not Harvard or mm-hmm. MIT, you know. This mm-hmm. is this is very far from everywhere in yeah. the world.
How much time do you spend there? Do you go back and forth between Belgium and...
Well, it is in season. I mean, it's I'm teaching there a total of 30 hours per year. I mean, around October, November. And then I have to go, let's say, a few times. So, I mean, and then I'm spending 2 days there. So it's not really cumbersome. I mean, mm-hmm. it's easy. Mm-hmm. And I get also, I get always transportation from the airport to the place. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, I mean, to get over there in České Budějovice, it's not obvious.
Right.
So this is not a San Francisco.
Right.
I get a very warm feeling. I mean, so mm-hmm. people, you know, are very helpful, and they know that. And this is also a joint project with Austria. Mm-hmm. So it's not only Czech, but also Austrian. Mm-hmm. And so students are mixed Czech, Austrian, and some even international.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. And then at antiviral conferences like the one being held here, you're in demand these
days,
yeah?
But that was a very special reason for that. That was because there was a special symposium in honor of Holy. Mm-hmm. So that I cannot guarantee I will be at all of these meetings. These are annual. And so it just happened I was there also last year in Sapporo. But then for a few years I've not been there. But now it was, a special reason was that it was dedicated to Holi. Mm-hmm. So that, of course, was for me a very necessary reason to be here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, surely, yes.
And I've in the meantime built up a very nice relationship with also the ambassador, the Belgian ambassador in Prague, and she has been very, instrumental when in this collaboration with the Holi. And so
from the beginning?
No, just as soon as she was ambassador, since 2007.
Uh-huh, okay.
And now her term is finished because 2012. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so she is past ambassador, but the title you can keep. We do not say ambassador emeritus or retired ambassador. Mm-hmm. So once you're ambassador, you can keep the title. Mm-hmm.
So she's here visiting Gilead with you.
Well, just in half an hour period. Yes. So the driver is waiting, and at 11 at the hotel there.
Yeah. And I'm sure you're a very honored guest at Gilead.
Well, at Gilead, I'm of course, let's say
a hero,
a usual guest. Yeah. So there, it's but now I'm very, for her, it's the first time, and she is with her husband, who is a journalist, or was a journalist at the Washington Post. So it's, and is still involved in journalistic affairs. I mean, it's, so it's interesting. And who knows, maybe one day she will write stories on the history or...
Yeah, well, it's a great story. We'll write something on this. We will be... telling the Gilead, so it's great to have it from you. Thanks for coming early. So we,
okay, yeah, I'm very grateful that.
I think we have you in time. Oh, it's perfect. Okay.
Yeah.
It's
okay. 11 o'clock. I will. Take away. Sorry that it has to be so fast, but if you need further information, I mean, you'll just keep in touch.
Sure. Certainly.
And. And I do not know how and where you're going to write the stories. I've written your stories on other people, and so they're very instructive because some of them I've known, and you may not even know, I mean, that one of them I've known very well, that is Jan Vilček.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. He is a Slovak. But, you know, in these days, mm-hmm. Czechoslovak were mm-hmm. united, mm-hmm. and he was a good friend of mine at that time.
Yeah.
So that is... So
that's
another fabulous
story.
That's another one. Yeah, sure. That's. Mm-hmm. I could tell you more about that even, because he has also written on the Zomer. So, and you can then see, sometimes you make associations between famous people.
Okay, yeah.
Because he has known the Zomer, and the Zomer has even been instrumental in him flying out of the country. Because that was arranged, he was from Bratislava, to Vienna, and he was allowed to go on vacation. But as soon as he was in Vienna, then he has come to Belgium. And then the Zomer got a little bit scared about, getting in problems. And so Vilček has continued to fly to New York.
Mm-hmm. That's a great story. Maybe we hear more details about that.
That by itself,
sometime.
It's a very nice story. I do not know whether Jan Vilček is still in good shape, but
I think he is. He's actually been in touch with us. So I don't know. I haven't met him in person, so. But I would like to talk to him also. And get
that should be very great. So I've also read you about read what you wrote about some of the others. I mean, so I was fascinated by this book of yours. I mean,
it's a wonderful job for us to be able to do this. It's difficult. We have to learn about so many different technologies.
and we have to get it.
And you have to always keep it in two pages.
Well, for that book, yeah. But we're writing a much more detailed scholarly history of the commercial industry. And we're also collecting these oral histories. We'll put a transcript together and send it back to you. You can review and correct it. And then with your permission, we'll publish it in our archive
with all of
the others. Yeah.
No, but, for any further information, I think it would be great. I mean, it's okay. And if you ever have a chance to come through Belgium or to come to Prague, I mean, well, in Prague, Holy has, of course, has disappeared. But, I mean, if you go from Prague a little bit further to Český Budějovice, you will have a very warm reception there. I mean, it's... he also came over here yesterday, Libor Grupofer, but he has already left. I mean, so he is no longer here. But he is a very warm person, and being the president of his university also is worth a complete coverage.
Yeah, very good. And well, thank you.
Okay.
Great.
So
you have to catch a car downstairs. They know where to come.
No, I have to go back.